Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. Welcome, Chief Simpson.
Thanks, Robert.
Reports from last week's meeting between the Assembly of First Nations and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau indicated he was on the defensive on a number of critical issues. Before we get into the details, how would you describe the mood of the Assembly members towards the Prime Minister?
I'm going to say that overall, the Assembly, there was mixed emotions and mixed moods in the Assembly chambers that day. There was a lot of concern about specific issues that affected First Nations, and there was a number of plenaries that we had previously seen that reflected a little bit of a disconnect between what we were trying to achieve and what the federal government was trying to achieve. So overall, I would say there was a little bit tense.
Without getting into the details, we'll do that in a minute. How would you describe the Prime Minister's tone as he responded overall to the concerns raised?
Well, I think he started off with his address, which covered a lot of bases, and it was optimistic, like most of his speeches. But of course, he wasn't getting into any specifics. And then it was once he was questioned on certain aspects that the tone shifted. Generally, he heard that the government wasn't doing enough for Indigenous people, despite the overwhelming evidence that some things needed to happen on certain issues. So I think he became more defensive and emotional as his address moved on.
How do you feel he did?
I think he did pretty good for the head of a government that's been in power for 10 years. I'm going to have to say that he said at first what he needed to, and generally he responded to the questions in the way that that he needed to. But I just think that after 10 years in government and seeing very limited movement on some of these issues we hold very dear, I think that it's moved beyond the need for talk and good words, and it's definitely time for action now in the 10th year of his government.
There are many who accuse the Prime Minister of breaking promises. What did they mean?
Well, when he first got in, he promised a nation-to-nation arrangement between the federal government and the First Nations. So that never came about. It makes me wonder if he knows what a nation-to-nation arrangement is. And it means that sovereign nations agree with each other. They talk to each other on a nation-to-nation level, the way we would talk to, say, the States or Britain or France or any other country. So that never happened. If anything, they just continued with the status quo as it was. So to me, that was the biggest thing. He was also called off for saying that the relationship with Indigenous First Nations was the most important relationship, and that's proven not to be true as well. So it doesn't matter what his intentions were, he never followed through on that. So we've seen a number of promises with the boiled water advisories supposed to be lifted. He promised a date that has come and passed, and there are still boiled water advisories, including one First Nation that's had one for 10 years now, and they are the poster child for these boiled water advisories. And he was told that chief was told that they were going to get fixed, and it never happened.
Has Trudeau's approach to Indigenous peoples changed the way the government and First Nations approach issues and resolve them?
I would say that almost aloof to our concerns, where we've constantly raised concerns, and the government, the federal government, feels like they can or they cannot, or they don't have to respond to them. And if they do, they act as though that they are making progress. They always have these great words. They happen to say that the right things. But again, the actions don't speak to the same level that their words do. So we need to see action at this point.
One of the more emotional moments came when a group of mothers whose children died at the hands of police took to the floor. Can you describe the exchange between these women and Trudeau?
Now, this was probably the most emotionally intense time of the assembly. We had four mothers of children who lost their lives at the hands of police and police brutality. One mother who lost two children. So it definitely changed the temperature and the mood in the room. There was a lot of smudging going on, and thank goodness the Assembly First Nation had designated people to smudge the rooms because we needed it at that point. So all those mothers had to be heard. They had to tell their story. And I think it was very good for the Prime Minister to hear that message. And in his response, I feel he responded properly. He actually seemed to get emotionally changed by the presentations. So I think that he did well. Especially since policing, for the most part, isn't a federal issue. The buck still has to stop with him. He is the top of the ladder when it comes to all things Canadian and government. But I think that at that point, the room changed to where it became almost hostile. And then people started calling out. And there was some, you know, maybe things that shouldn't have happened. And I just felt like that we needed to bring the temperature down at that, but at the same time, not disregard the statements of the mothers.
How do you control something like that? I mean, when it's so emotional and it's so deeply felt, how can you possibly even control anything in terms of exchanges and what people say?
Well, I think we all know that there's a code of conduct in the assembly chambers. So everyone's made aware of that code, and it's up to the chairs of the assembly to instigate any repercussions for that. But at the same time, they let everyone know that the assembly is there for the chiefs and that they're just there to enforce the rules that the chiefs have agreed to. So I feel like from previous assemblies, maybe the chairs should step in a little bit more just to ensure that there's a proper level of civility among the chiefs. It's supposed to be a safe place in the assembly chambers. So it got to the point where regional chiefs, she came to the podium near the end, and she said that she was very concerned when things started getting heated, that she had to take her two young children out of the assembly room because they started getting scared and started crying just because of all the yelling and frustrations that were coming out. So she said that that's unacceptable, and that, you know, we have to be doing better. This assembly is supposed to be a safe place for everybody. So when it starts to not feel that, then I think it's time to take some actions. And at that point, I think it should have been the chairs.
Beyond the issues we've touched on, what else was discussed during Trudeau's time?
Well, there was the issue of the police brutality. That I think that was the main one. The drinking water issue was another very touchy issue. So the chief of that First Nation that I was mentioning earlier, where they've been on a boiled water advisory for 10 years, he actually had to you know, really make sure he got to the microphone. So they weren't going to give him the extra time. So he ensured he got the extra time because it is such an important issue, not just for his First Nation, for all First Nations in Canada. So I am glad that he was allotted that time to address Trudeau on the water issues. So I think that was really big too. And another big issue that came up, but not during the time Trudeau was there, was the human trafficking that's happening in the country. And I think that's an issue that we probably should have brought forward to Trudeau at the time. But of course, with the time constraints, he was only allotted 20 minutes, but he did stay for about 45 minutes to 50 minutes. So he actually stayed much longer than he was intending to. So I think that we should acknowledge that at least.
NDP leader Jagmeet Singh appeared as well. Can you tell us the audience's reaction to his address?
Well, I think that they received him a little bit better than Trudeau. He last assembly when he addressed, he spoke for about 45 minutes to an hour, and he was very favorably received. I think First Nations generally aligned with the NDP platform, just in terms of the social issues like housing and education. We support these things. We support improving these conditions, social conditions for our people. So I think generally he probably got the best response of all of the leaders there.
What's your impression of him and what he said at the meeting?
Generally, I like what he says. He is very qualified for his position. He knows the issues. Much like NDP leaders before, they know their stuff going in. They know what needs changing. They have their finger on the pulse of the nation and what people really are looking for, not companies, but what the actual people need. So I feel like he did very well, and the NDP are definitely a viable option for anybody. But you know, it's it's politics, so you never really know how things are going to go.
Bloc Québécois leader Yves-François Blanchet also appeared, and it was his first time. What was your reaction to his appearance?
Well, he probably received the frostiest reception of all of the leaders who spoke. I'm not sure if there was a language barrier, or and a lot of the chiefs, I don't think, understood what he was saying because he was speaking in French. So I think because of that barrier, they weren't necessarily able to hear his message, even though it was translated on the big screens. So I think, I'm not sure how much the Bloc has to offer First Nations people. So I think that's another reason he wasn't received too warmly. But again, you have to give him kudos for even coming and addressing the assembly, knowing how leaders in the past have been treated. So I'm glad he came out. But of course, he has to hear what First Nations are really concerned about.
He was told by one chief that the lands in Quebec were never ceded and people can start packing. Is that rhetoric useful?
I don't think so. To me, anytime you're going to go there, you're basically shutting down the debate. You can't start with a debate killer if you are actually truly trying to engage in a useful conversation. So I think maybe if they didn't say that, then perhaps he would be more willing to discuss further. But to me, I think you need to keep that sort of rhetoric away. It doesn't really have a use in negotiations. So that was probably someone just getting the emotions got the best of them, is probably my guess.
Opposition leader Pierre Poilievre was a no-show. He did come to your meeting in July, though. What was the reaction to his absence?
Well, I don't know if he would have said anything different than he said in the summer. His message was entirely economic based. He doesn't seem to be interested in reconciliation or Indigenous rights or any type of acknowledgement of Indigenous sovereignty. So his message is basically the same message to anybody in Canada. It doesn't matter if we're a First Nation or a European or anybody, it's his message doesn't change. So it means he doesn't understand that First Nations are unique in Canada, and we have a unique basket of issues that need to be dealt with, especially the fact that these are Indigenous lands that Canada sits on.
The rejection of the child welfare agreement for $47.8 billion over 10 years was another topic. Can you update us on what took place on this issue at the Assembly?
Well, I think basically they reaffirmed what happened in the assembly a couple months ago, the special assembly where we rejected it. It sounds like we now have to get behind the fact that we're going back to the negotiation table. We need to address the issues of concern that the chiefs out west raised. And we just have to cross our fingers, hope that we get a better settlement than we had before. So we're pretty much all in the same boat now. And it feels like, we just have our fingers crossed and are hoping for the best at this point.
Please stay tuned to hear more Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tanar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tanar Simpson, the Chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you're joining us. The Assembly passed a motion calling for an inquiry into systemic racism by police against First Nations. What is your impression of Trudeau's response that he will, quote, do everything in his power to fix it?
Well, I'm suspect of that statement because he could have done these changes anytime in the last decade, and we're dealing with it now. And police brutality against First Nations people is at it seems to be at its height. I don't remember it being this bad in the past. When we're talking about 30 people who lost their lives in, you know, just a span of a few months, that's unacceptable. We had 7 in one weekend alone, 7 First Nations people killed by police in one weekend. That's entirely unacceptable. It is a crisis. It's to the point now where something needs to be done. We've always known that police racism and brutality against First Nations people has been there. It's one of the reasons why half of the people and over half of the people in jail are First Nations people. There is systemic racism at all levels of the justice system against First Nations. That's from when police first apprehend or approach First Nations. Because they're First Nation, they tend to be escalated through the system. And then charges go. And then in the legal court system, they tend to be the ones that actually get convicted and thrown in jail, as opposed to non-First Nations people tend to get off. So all of these factors throughout the whole system lead to the high incarceration rate of First Nations. And the fact that a lot of First Nations are being killed during the first encounters with police is not surprising, just because this is systemic racism that has never been addressed in the Canadian system.
We were just talking about a similar issue the last time you and I spoke, and we were talking about Murray Sinclair and the work that he did decades ago into the legal system's treatment of Indigenous people. Now, there have been many reports on this topic at various levels. Only a year ago, BC released a report saying Indigenous people were overrepresented in terms of interactions with police. But there are so many of these. Missing and murdered Indigenous women in 2019, the RCMP systemic racism report in 2022, Thunder Bay police this past year were called on to disband. Reports released earlier this year identify the issues. Why do we need an inquiry when there are so many reports that have come to the same conclusion?
Well, I think a lot of these reports, as you said with the Thunder Bay, they're isolated. People can say, oh, that's Thunder Bay. You know, that would never happen here in London, Ontario, or here in Vancouver, BC, when we know that they are. So I think a national level inquiry can get national level recommendations across the board. Doesn't matter what police force you are, what province you are, what city you're in. A national report will be able to make these changes and hopefully get implemented across the board at all police service levels.
Why do you think there's a lack of action in the face of this overwhelming evidence that both you and I have described today?
I'm going to say it's because you can't really fix racism. If you have racist ideas in your mind, it doesn't matter how much training you take, how much people tell you that it's wrong, you will carry these thoughts forward with you. And if you're a police officer and you're going in to interact with the First Nations person, they're going to come out, and it doesn't really matter what you've been told.
Now, you were there for several days at the assembly, and you and I have talked about all the high profile things. What do you recall from the meeting that we haven't talked about that you think people should know about?
Well, I guess maybe two things come to mind. First was the plenary on human trafficking. To me, I think that was even more emotional than the discussion on police brutality. We had a few speakers who came in, and what they were talking about was heart-wrenching. It's right up there with the residential school system, something that is ingrained in the system that is horrible. And it was just very sad to hear these facts and these statements. It's good to know that some people have taken up the effort to combat this. But to me, that was very emotional, and it just made me think, you know, I came away thinking this has to be addressed right now. So I think that should be part of the national conversation moving forward.
When you're talking about human trafficking, can you describe what's taking place and where you see the injustice?
Well, it's, There's a lot of aspects to human trafficking. It exists in a lot of different ways, from outside sources to inside the family sources. But I think one of the big things that came around, and not to point fingers at anybody in particular, but the shipping industry with these big container ships was identified as a source of human trafficking and some severe abuses. So there's an effort that's saying like all container ships should be searched for evidence of human trafficking and victims of human trafficking. So that was something that came up. I'm not sure if there's others, but we've heard about these camps. So these labor camps where, you know, they're building massive infrastructure projects. We know that those are also hotbeds of human trafficking. So it's a matter of identifying where it is and actually doing something about it. If you know human trafficking is happening in a spot, send the police and rescue these victims. It seems pretty straightforward.
Now, are you talking about human trafficking on an international scale? Are you talking about human trafficking as it relates to Indigenous people? Can you maybe clarify that a bit?
Well, human trafficking in terms of Indigenous people is far greater than the general population. So I'm not sure if they said the majority of human trafficking is Indigenous women and girls, but it's right up there. I think something like 7 times more likely to be trafficked, as well as men is too. It's not just women and girls. There's young men who are being trafficked as well. So it's sort of across the board. It doesn't matter where you're from. It's happening in all cities, all towns, everywhere. And it's something that I don't know what the answer is, but it needs to be dealt with.
I'd like to move on. You were at a meeting held at the Empire Club recently to discuss infrastructure projects. Why was this significant?
Well, I think it's important in today's age of duty to consult. These large proponents, these large corporations, like in the past, they've been just going ahead as business as usual. You know, they don't see value in land beyond what it can do for their specific industry or business in terms of building industry or taking resources off the land. So I think it was about bringing Indigenous people into the discussion, how that they need to recognize that these are Indigenous lands. There are treaty rights on these lands. You have to engage with the First Nations, who are the treaty rights holders on these territories. So I think the Empire Club did a very good effort, made a great effort to try to broach that. And they came clean at the beginning. They said, you know, Gray Owl stood on this stage here to address us. And they said, we understand that we have a long way to go to improve that. So I feel like they did make progress, and they made First Nations people feel welcome there. And they gave a voice to First Nations to be able to discuss these issues. And Cindy Woodhouse was the guest speaker, National Chief Cindy Woodhouse.
You've touched on a couple of topics, and I'd like you to become a little more specific if you could. What responsibilities do corporations have towards Indigenous people today?
Well, starting from the very beginning, if you have an idea, you're a corporation, you're like, I want to build this project on this land here. The very first thing you need to do is you need to identify who are the First Nations in that territory that hold the treaty rights to that land. And you need to engage with them before you come up with their plan. Before you don't come and say, this is what we're going to do, what do you think? You need to open that discussion even before you come up with that idea. Say, this is what we're doing. We would love to be engaged with you. So right off the hop, First Nations can say, there's no way we're going to allow that on our territory. Say it's like a uranium mine, or, you know, they want to store nuclear waste right there. So they need to be upfront about what their intentions are. So then once we're at the table, we can help align the interests of both the proponent and the First Nation so that you come up with the final solution that works for you. So this can be any type of industry. Right now, I think mining needs the most work, because mining at this point is able to supersede all consultation in Ontario. Overall, the energy projects that we're dealing with, they do have that, and they want to engage us in terms of our companies helping to build the project, in terms of having some sort of equity partnership. And right now it seems to be a 50% ownership is the standard that you would want to have. So if they want to build an energy project on our territory, you know what, you gotta have to be willing to give up 50% of that ownership to First Nations. And we feel like that's just a starting point. So, I mean, if you're going to build on our land that is legally ours, then we feel like that's proper.
We've talked in the past about the duty to consult. We've also talked in the past about government contracts and certain practices of claims of indigeneity that are not true. A lot of times corporations come in and Indigenous people are just, it's like another activist group that a corporation has to deal with. How do we change the conversation?
Well, that's a really good question, because this is something that's been evolving for the last 20 years. Say 20 years ago, any corporation wanting to build and meet those requirements for consulting, they could choose any Indigenous person, Métis, Inuit, First Nation from anywhere in the country and say, we partnered with the Indigenous entity, so we're moving forward with our project. So it's gone from there to now knowing that you have to have the original treaty holders in that spot to negotiate with. So it's changing to the point where we don't know what it's going to look like in a few years, but it is moving towards the better, and we're hoping to continue to see it moving forward. But right now, some corporations, they do feel as though that duty to consult is optional. And we're here to tell you that it's not an option, and we're not another special interest group. They like to use that terminology. Well, we can't, you know, consider everybody special interest, but First Nations interests as the landholders, the title holders, have a unique interest.
Oftentimes, these discussions and the results circle around wealth as being a goal. Is that true, or are there other objectives that can meet the needs of both sides that are not necessarily centered around the creation of wealth?
Well, that again, that's another really good question there, Robert. So we are looking at partnerships on all levels, and if they can engage First Nations companies to help with their projects, that's great. But when it comes to own source revenue for First Nations, everyone's always complaining about the Indian Act and Indian Affairs, you know, all that money that's being spent. This is a solution to that. This is a way for First Nations to have their own source income, to be able to govern their own projects, to be able to choose their own destiny. So this really offers the key to getting out from under the Indian Act, to abolishing Indian Affairs once and for all. If we actually follow this framework through to its natural course, then First Nations will be able to stand on their own two feet on their own and finally achieve that that nation-to-nation goal that we're looking for.
Walking away from the meeting, how did you feel?
It felt pretty good. I mean, none of these things feel like perfect, like, okay, we done it, you know, wipe our hands and say, hey, mission solved. Each of these things are just one step forward to that inevitable goal that we are trying to achieve as sovereign nations. So you never feel like everything was done properly. It's always, there's more to do. It's just like, okay, we've taken this small step. Now we're ready for the next step.
So what announcements do you have for us this time?
Okay, good question. So I was thinking originally that there wasn't a lot going to be going on because it's the Christmas shutdown, but we actually have quite a lot for me to announce right now. First of all, for everyone wondering, for the members, our offices will be open on January 6th after a two-week shutdown. So if you want to contact them at the band office, you'll have to wait till January 6th. So I'd also like to say that on December 18th, we're going to have our winter solstice ceremony, and that starts at 6 p.m. at the Hilltop, and it's open to all members. We also have intensive Anishinaabe Mohan course happening at January 11th to 12th, and also February 1st to 2nd. So if you're a member looking to improve your Anishinaabe Mohan, which is the Ojibwe language, please contact Shona Smoke. And this is going to be held 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. on those 4 days. And you have to be in attendance for all 4 days to sign up. We have a bingo night January 11th. So this is something we're happy to start to bring back because we took down our big bingo board in the community center. So this is, we're not going to have the big board back, but we are doing a bingo night January 11th at the community center. And We have a woman's full moon ceremony January 13th at 5 p.m. at Hilltop. If you're a member and you're looking to attend that, please contact Jana or Aiden at the Health Services Building. And coming up on January 14th, there's a budgeting workshop happening for First Nations members. Say you need a little bit of help budgeting, or you know, you're trying to stretch your finances to meet all your financial goals, then please sign up for the January 14th workshop. And then I guess on January 25th, we have our spring community meeting. Now, this is we try to have these meetings 3 to 4 times a year. So if you're interested in knowing the important updates and what we're planning for the year ahead, please come out to that meeting. So that's my announcements for this coming month. And I hope to spread that word to all of our members. Megwich.
Chief Tanner Simpson, thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tanar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tanar Simpson.